read chapter 10. Don't fall asleep in chapter 10. And then come out in chapter 11. Actually, instead of not falling asleep, the contest is whichever person can memorize and correctly pronounce all names in chapter 10 doesn't have to come back. Just kidding. Yeah, so chapter 10 and then chapter 11, which is the story of the Tower of Babel, and then another genealogy. You're gonna get your fair share of weird names with the next reading. But take that through for Sunday, all the way through chapter 11, noting that we actually have a pretty sharp break in chapter 11 and verse 27. Another one of these instances of this is the book of the generations of this is the list of the descendants of, in this case, Terah, who is the father of Abraham. So this is the last section within the first main section of content in Genesis. We'll talk through that on Sunday. Sam will lead us in that discussion. I think we'll have a review period after that. And there may be one other thing going on, and then we'll get into that text starting with Abraham in a couple of weeks. So tonight, though, we are finishing up the story of Noah and the flood. Before we do that, Joel, can I ask you to say a quick prayer for us, please? Sorry to put you on the spot there, but
Heavenly Father, we thank you for this time that we have to study. We ask that you be with us, strengthen and guide us, help us to glean as much as we possibly can from the study of Genesis. At this point, we glory in the blood. Heavenly Father, thank you for each and every one that's present here tonight, and those that are on the way. You can teach us that they share what they study.
So this is where we stopped on Sunday. We were in the middle of talking through the character of Noah, and we said that really the only discernible quality we have about Noah from the text of Genesis is his righteousness before God and his obedience to the commandments of God, which in one way is sort of all there is to say about a person, right? Noah is in that way kind of the paradigm for who one of God's people should be, a person of obedience. But we noted that, you know, in this entire story, Noah doesn't say anything. We're not given Noah's recorded words or thoughts or even directly his actions in the situation, right? This story comes to us in the form of instructions from the mouth of God to Noah, and then just the statement that Noah did what God said, right? So Noah is in some ways just kind of an incidental character here in this story. Again, it is important that he is righteous before God, but this is not a story that is primarily about Noah, even though it's about Noah, if you know what I mean by that. This is actually a story, and I hope to kind of point this out as we go through this. This is actually a story about God and what happens to God through the exercise of judgment on the world. We'll get into that a little bit in a minute. I do think it's interesting, and you can see it kind of in this rendering if you can see that. I do think it's interesting that there's this tradition that Noah was someone who, for a lack of a better word, evangelized to his generation, to warn them of the impending flood, to have them, you know, repent so that God could save them. I don't see that in Genesis. It's not really there. I know that in the New Testament you've got a couple of references to Noah as, I think 2 Peter calls him a herald of righteousness. So this idea that he's a preacher or a herald. But that's not described to us in any kind of way in Genesis. It appears to me that Noah is, in some ways, kind of a solitary character here, he and his family. They're alone. And it's not God's intention here to try to save as many people as he can, right? God's intention here is one of judgment and destruction. And Noah is just sort of the sole means by which God is going to carry humanity through the flood and out to the other side of it. But there's no sense here that God is necessarily trying to rescue the world in this action. This is a definitive act of judgment that in some ways has to occur for humanity and the world to come out on the other side of it as God intended. And yet, even with that, I think we'll see some interesting things later about, you know, what is it that has changed about the world in light of the flood. So just kind of keep that in mind. I don't know entirely what to do with that, but it's almost here as if God has sort of made the pronouncement, made the judgment, it's resolved in his mind. Noah is going to be the sole one through whom humanity will continue on. Okay, so if we actually start looking into the flood itself, which starts here in the middle of chapter 7, right? God tells Noah to go into the ark. And if you look through the details, if you were reading through this, maybe you caught this like I did, there are a lot of details here about time. There's a lot of things throughout this story about how long things took, right? So you've got Noah enters the ark in his 600th year. The flood begins 7 days later in the second month on the 17th day. Rain falls for 40 days and 40 nights. Water continues on the earth for 150 days. On the seventh month, on the 17th day, the ark comes to rest on the mountain. It takes 3 months for the waters to recede. There are 40 days to send out the raven, and then another 7 for the dove, and then another 7 for the dove again. The water gets fully dried from the earth on the first month of the first day of Noah's 601st year. Noah leaves the ark in the second month on the 27th day. All of these details are here, right? There's this sort of repetition of just how long this has taken. And when you sort of add it all up, Noah's in the ark for over a year. For over 13 months, in fact. So that kind of gives us a little bit of a scope of what we're dealing with here, right? The old children's story is that, you know, the rain falls for 40 days and 40 nights, and yet the extent of this event is much longer. Noah and his family become the only people who live on the earth for over an entire year. Not even on the earth is kind of a, probably shouldn't have said it that way, but you know what I mean. So you've got all of this time that happens, right? And the purpose of the flood here is twofold. It is primarily about judgment and destruction, right? You see that at the end of chapter 7 in verse 23. He, that is God, blotted out every living thing that was on the face of the ground. Human beings and animals and creeping things and birds of the air, they were blotted out from the earth. Only Noah was left and those that were with him in the ark. Right? So there's this judgment where God is sort of wiping the slate clean in terms of what the world is. But we also get this sense of salvation and recreation or new creation. And there are some things in the text that actually suggest that, starting in chapter 8, which we'll get into in a minute. But you can kind of see this actually with a description of how the flood begins, right? So, how does the flood start? What does the scripture say about that? What's the process by which the flood actually begins? This is in the middle of chapter 7. Right. So you've got this sort of dual thing going on, right? Where you've got water that comes up from the earth, right? The seas and the water and the deep, as it's called, bursts forth, and you've got this flood of water. And that is combined with the windows of the heavens being opened and the rain falling from heaven. You remember that in the creation, on the second day, God creates the expanse and separates the waters from the waters, right? And so you've got this idea that both sides of that now to sort of pour and dispense water over the face of the ground. right, so you've got the deep bursting forth, you've got rain from the heavens, and the rain itself falls for 40 days and 40 nights, but the water continues to increase and increase and increase for 150 days. And the text says that, in verse 18 of chapter 7, the waters swelled and increased greatly on the earth. And the ark floated on the face of the waters. The waters swelled so mightily on the earth that all the high mountains under the whole heaven were covered. The waters swelled above the mountains, covering them 15 cubits deep. That's about 25 feet, right? So water so expansive that it covers all of the mountains and exceeds that, so that this ark that was built by Noah floats on top of the waters. The idea here is just this complete saturation of the world in water. And here's why that's significant. First of all, we saw the commentary earlier about Noah and his family being the only ones left alive. But look at chapter 8 and what's described here. When the floodwaters finally stop, in chapter 8 and verse 1, we'll talk about this phrase, God remembered Noah, in a minute. But if you look at the last half of that verse, God made a wind to blow over the earth, and the waters subsided. The fountains of the deep and the windows of the heavens were closed, and the rains from the heavens were restrained, and the waters gradually receded from the earth. What does all that remind you of that we've already seen? Some of it we talked about earlier, but especially this idea about God making a wind to blow over the earth. Does that sound like anything? Yeah. Right. So, this idea of, in chapter 1, that when God begins to make the earth, the Spirit of God hovers or moves over the face of the waters, over the face of the deep. And here, when the earth itself has been sort of transformed back into that state where it is just complete water and nothing but water, here you have God recreating after He has stopped the waters in an effort to have the waters begin to recede. God makes the wind or the spirit, right? Those words are basically the same idea, right? Spirit and wind are related terms. God makes the wind to blow over the earth and the waters begin to subside. And there He closes up the fountains of the deep. You've got, I think, an echo here of the original process of creation, where God created the world out of water at the beginning. God has essentially reverted the earth to that state and is now bringing it back from that. And so what you have in the flood is, in some ways, an act of recreation by God, right? This is, as we've said before, God hitting the reset button on the world. So in doing this, it results in this kind of complete annihilation of the world, and yet along with that you've got Noah here and his family in the ark, really kind of just waiting it out in some ways. We'll talk about what's actually going on in the ark in a little bit. Any questions or comments about anything you see in chapter 7 about the flood that was interesting? We don't have time to get through all of the little details here, but anything that you saw that was meaningful or significant? Yeah, Mike. Right. 1 Peter. Right. So you've got a parallel with the New Testament taking this story and making a parallel to baptism, right? Salvation by water. That's an interesting analogy. I think we don't have time to get into that passage in 1 Peter, but I do think it's interesting that he takes the story of the flood to be this kind of salvation through water. That's a little bit of a different perspective, I think, than what's just sort of right here in Genesis. So it's interesting that he takes that. Good. All right. So we've got this flood that is engulfing the earth, through which God is going to not only destroy the world, but recreate the world and save Noah and humanity through that. So the floodwaters, once they reach their peak, and we read about that earlier, where they come over the height of the mountains, and in chapter 7, verse 24, they swell on the earth for 150 days. The story changes here in chapter 8 and verse 1, and it takes a pretty dramatic turn. God remembered Noah. You find that word interesting? God remembered Noah, as if he had maybe forgotten about him in some way. I actually think there's some reasoning behind this. Again, it occurs to me that this is a story in which all of the action, for the most part, takes place through the speech of God, through the actions of God. Again, Noah doesn't really do much of anything in the story other than follow the commands of God. And what's interesting here, and we'll see this in a minute, is God tells Noah to enter the ark. And then after all of this instruction that God has given, God doesn't speak to Noah anymore when Noah is in the ark. God doesn't say anything else to Noah for the entire course of this year plus that he's there until he tells him, go out of the ark. I think what you might have going on here is this idea that, you know, what God is doing is God is judging the world. He's out there causing the flood, causing the waters to swell, creating this destruction and reset of the creation. And Noah and his family are put in the ark, and they're just floating along. They're just waiting it out in many ways, right? We don't have any description of what Noah is doing in the ark or anything like that. We just have a depiction about the state of the world outside and then the eventual sort of process by which Noah is able to then leave the ark. It seems almost as if once Noah gets into the ark, right, and God shuts the door, right, it seems as if once Noah enters the ark, his communication with God is cut off, and God is busy outside the ark doing what he's going to do to bring destruction on the world. And God isn't really involved in what's going on in the ark with Noah. God's not really present in the ark with Noah, if you could say it that way. That wouldn't be an absolute way of saying it, but I think God's focus is in the act of judgment here. But then with chapter 8, God remembers Noah, right? God remembers Noah. And that's the point at which God then causes these waters to cease to swell and to recede upon the earth. And so that one statement there in chapter 8 at the very beginning, I think, is pretty indicative of a change in God's perspective in terms of what he's doing within the story. That's the point at which he does make the wind to blow over the earth and the waters begin to subside. So when the flood recedes, again, God remembers Noah. We get this statement that the ark comes to rest on Mount Ararat. I had read that this word rest here is that same word that we saw back in chapter 4, this concept that Lamech said that Noah would bring relief to humanity. This word Noah, the Hebrew word from which Noah's name is taken is a word which means rest and relief. And so you've got a little bit of a play on words here where once this stops, once the process stops, the ark begins, you know, the ark itself rests on the mountain. Again, you've got this gradual receding of the waters that takes a really long time. And Noah has to resort to sending out the birds in order to be able to mark the status of the earth and the floodwaters. So you've got Noah sending out birds of various kinds to be able to determine whether or not there's dry land enough for him to leave the ark. And it seems that once he has made that determination, right? Once he sends out the dove for the last time and the dove doesn't come back, that he takes that as the clue. And then we're told at that point that God tells Noah to go out of the ark. This is chapter 8 and verse 15. Then God said to Noah, "Go out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you. Bring out with you every living thing that is with you of all flesh, birds and animals and every creeping thing and things that creep on the earth, so that they may abound on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth." We'll talk about that phrase here in just a second. So Noah is finally able to leave the ark, and when he does that, finally we're going to get some sort of direct interaction between God and Noah. We're going to see what happens when Noah comes out of the ark as the only person there is, he and along with his family. So I want to talk through from here, basically through chapter 8 and verse 20, through the end of, chapter 9, through the middle of chapter 9 and verse 17. All of this is, again, this is mostly in the words of God, right? This is going to be speech of God about the promises that he's going to make to Noah and through Noah, and the covenant that God is going to make with Noah. Do you remember that in the beginning we said that the way that God primarily relates to human beings throughout Genesis is through the means of covenant? And here we have sort of the first instance of that within the story. And this is in many ways kind of a prologue or a preamble to the larger covenant that he's going to give with Abraham, starting in chapters 12 and 13 and following. But this is a covenant that God is going to make with Noah, and this is primarily about God's dealings with the world in the aftermath of this destructive flood. But I want to look at this through the lens of a particular question that I think might have been included on your sheet that would accompany your reading for this time, which is this question: what's changed here after the flood? What's different? And if anything's different, then what's the same, right? About human beings, about the earth, about relationship with God, about the way that they behave. What's different here as a result of the flood? So just kind of think about that as we go through some of this stuff, right? So the first thing that happens when Noah leaves the ark is that Noah offers up worship to God. He does so by building an altar. This is the first of many references that we have in Genesis in the Old Testament to altars as being the way that sacrifices would be performed by God's people. And what Moses effectively offers here is similar to what becomes within the sacrifices of the priests of Israel in later times. This is effectively a whole burnt offering. And these burnt offerings were later associated with sort of the redemption of sin, but also with petition and thanksgiving. And so when Noah comes out of the ark and he offers up these burnt offerings to God, it's not so much sort of this solemn act of contrition on Noah's part as much as it is, I think, an act of joy and an act of praise for God. So this really is an act of worship on Noah's part. And in verse 21, it says that God smelled the aroma of Noah's sacrifices. And as a result of that, or at least accompanying it, he makes a promise. And you'll notice that this is a kind of internal dialogue with God, right? God says this, it says, in his heart, which echoes back to the to before the flood, when God resolving to send the flood was a matter of His heart being grieved over the sin of humanity. Here, God speaks to Himself. God speaks to His heart. And what's interesting, I think, here is God's line of reasoning. He says that He's not going to curse the ground anymore because, or even though, or for, and there's some question about what that transitional term there is in verse 21. But in any case, He's not going to curse the ground again because the inclination of the human heart is evil from youth. So I think that's interesting, right? God is going to destroy the world because of this intense whole evilness that is upon the world, right? And God is going to judge and eradicate that through the flood. And yet, here's Noah, right after the flood. He comes out, he builds an altar, he offers worship, and automatically, God seems aware of this idea of the natural fault of human beings, right? God says, the inclination of the human heart is evil from youth. So, has anything about people changed with the flood? So what's changed here? What was the point? What was the effect? I think that this is I don't know if change in perspective is the right way to say it, but this is just as much of a commitment on God's part as was His resolution to destroy the world. But here, it is sort of in the opposite way, a resolution to not again do that, right? And so, I think what you have here is what amounts to a substitution of grace for judgment, right? And that God's perspective on humanity and the earth itself changes. Now, I don't know that that means, in fact, I don't think it means that God's sending of the flood was like the wrong thing to do. Surely not. But it does seem to me that in the face of that act of judgment, that God almost has, I don't know if this is the right way to say it or not, it's almost as if God has a realization that salvation for humanity is not going to come through judgment of that scope, but it's going to come through grace and the commitment to not enact His wrath and judgment upon the earth. And so, you've got this resolution here on God's part. This is a promise internal to God's own mind and heart, that He's no longer going to punish by cursing the ground and by breaking this or driving this wedge between the creature and the creation itself, right? He says actually that the promise is to not curse the ground, right? That goes all the way back to the punishments first established with Adam in Genesis chapter 3, right? What, you going to say something?
Focused on the Israelites who were
doesn't work that way.
Right,
right. Yeah, I think that's a good point. In that, I mean, we can take a lesson here about the mind and the heart of God, and yet there's sort of on, you know, if you labor on top of that, the idea that this speaks to people who would have that attitude. Yeah, I think that's certainly fair. Yeah. All right. So you've got this commitment by God, this promise to Noah that he makes here. And he says both before this and after this another phrase, which again harkens back to Genesis 1. We've seen so many allusions back to that. Again, I think this sort of continues with the theme that what God is doing here is an act of recreation. He says in verse 1 of chapter 9, God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth." Right, the blessing to humanity to be the one to populate the earth. So that is also pretty much the same in terms of who humanity is and will be and is intended to be. God still intends them to be, in some way, the people through whom He is He's represented in the world, and they're the ones through whom the earth will be filled. Now, there is a little bit of a difference here in chapter 9 as it relates to how people relate to the animals. And I think this is interesting. I can't entirely explain this. But notice that in chapter 9, verse 1, remember, says, "Be fruitful and multiply." And then verse 2, "The fear and dread of you shall rest on every animal of the earth and on every bird of the air and on everything that creeps on the ground," etc., etc. And so there appears to be this relationship between people and animals that is different. Specifically, God is going to give them the right to eat meat. Before this kind, before the flood, it was strictly a vegetarian diet for people, right? God gives the trees and the plants for food. Here, God appears to make a concession to human beings about being able to eat flesh. And yet even that has its own caveats. And I wonder if what this is really about is a provision against, say, that violence that existed on the earth prior to the flood. Remember that at least a part of the sin that was described there was the great amount of violence that existed. Because notice how the text moves here. Notice how this statement of God moves from eating flesh to don't kill other people, right? So we read, verse 3. "Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And just as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything. Only you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. For your own life blood I will surely require a reckoning. From every animal I will require it, and from human beings, each one for the blood of another, I will require a reckoning for human life. Whoever sheds the blood of a human by a human, shall that person's blood be shed." And so there's this transition here from eating flesh of animals to don't eat it with the blood, because the blood is life. And if you do that, there will be recompense for that on God's part, and that God will require it not only in apparently the eating of animals, but in taking the blood of another and in shedding the blood of another human being. Right? There's kind of a transition, and I can't fully explain exactly how that logic works, but there seems to be a transition here, which makes me think that what this is a provision against that violent inclination that human beings were expressing in their pre-flood existence. There's a lot of questions to be left around that for certain. But I will say that at the conclusion of all of that, an important thing that God does maintain here in verse 6 is that human blood is not to be shed, because man is made in God's image, right? In His own image, God made humankind, there at the end of verse 6. And so, even with this other provision about animals, the root of who humanity is still even remains the same. This is God's creation. This is God's image in the human beings that He's made. Okay, so with the rest of the terms of the covenant here, and this is where we get into some of the more familiar territory with the covenant. It's actually formally established with bookend statements in verse 8 and in verse 17 here in chapter 9. Then God said to Noah and to his sons with him, "As for me, I am establishing my covenant with you and your descendants after you." And then in verse 17, God said to Noah, "This is the sign of the covenant that I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth." So the formal grant of the covenant begins in verses 8 and 9 and goes through verse 17. And this is really about the sign of the covenant that God is going to give, right? God has already maintained this promise to not destroy the world, not curse the ground. This is going to be specified to destruction by flood here in verses 11 and 12. So it says in verse 11, "I establish my covenant with you that never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of a flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth." And then God sets the sign of the covenant. And there's a couple of things that are interesting about this. There's going to be a few places in the Torah where God gives signs of covenants, right? And again, this is the first kind of related covenant that God makes with human beings. And those are typically marked by designated signs, right? So here you have the sign of the bow or the rainbow. And with the covenant with Abraham, you have the sign of the covenant being circumcision. And even when you have the children of Israel having left Exodus and they go out to Mount Sinai and Moses receives the law and the Ten Commandments, there you have the Sabbath kind of returning, even that hearkening back to the seventh day of creation when God rests, right? The Sabbath becomes the sign of the covenant in that way for the people of Israel. Here the sign of the covenant is the bow or the rainbow. And I think that has its own kind of obvious quality for why that would be an appropriate sign here, right? The rainbow frequently appearing after the rainstorm. But it's also been suggested that, and I know this is not something that we would typically think of, but may have been more relevant for the people of the day who would have read this, that the resonance here is just as much actually about the shape of the bow and the image that would have had as a weapon of violence. Right, so bow as in bow and arrow, and that what this symbol may in some way represent is sort of an ironic symbol of God taking a shape that would have been one that would have symbolized violence and making it a symbol of peace. Right, this is a shape that might indicate destruction, and yet God makes it a shape that indicates peace and stability in the world, that there will no longer be this kind of destruction. So it probably has a dual resonance for that. But one final thing about this that I think is really interesting. Who is the rainbow for? Yeah, in verse 14, "When I bring clouds over the earth and the bow is seen in the clouds, I will remember my covenant that is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh, and the waters shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. When the bow is in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of flesh that is on the earth. This is put in the sky almost as if God has to remind himself of what he has promised here, right? This is something that God looks upon and sees and remembers in order to avert his wrath, as if God's wrath were kind of always at hand, and yet, oh. And so God has to recall this. I think that's just one more indication here that part of what you've got in this story is, again, a change on God's part in his commitment to humanity, that he is no longer going to destroy, that he's no longer going to act in this sort of full-scale judgment upon the world, and certainly not in this way through the flood. But that God's judgment does in this story change to an act of grace. And really, the next covenant that God's going to make is with the person who is going to be the one through whom God's people will be established, and through whom all the people of the world would be blessed, right? And so in many ways, this is sort of a precursor to the covenant that God is going to make with Abraham. Any questions or thoughts or ideas about that? So at the end of chapter 9, you have another story, and we probably won't get too far into it other than to say this. With verse 18, we have a story that I think most of us might think of as the story about Noah's own kind of sin, Noah's drunkenness and nakedness. But if you actually look at this story and the way that it's presented, this is not a story about Noah. And that becomes a little bit of a challenge for us. This is not a story about Noah. This is a story about Noah's sons. And specifically, about how they come to be the ones through whom the earth gets repopulated. This is sort of an origin story of that event as well. So, all of a sudden, these three sons of Noah, which have been kind of incidental to the story, all of a sudden, they become really important, specifically in the way that they react to Noah's nakedness and drunkenness here. The consequence, you'll notice here, is not on Noah for anything that Noah does. And I think that's a challenge. Remember, we said there were going to be times in Genesis where we're going to look at what God's people do and say, you know, they should have done that and that's wrong. And that's fair to do. And yet I think it's important that the emphasis of this story is upon the sin, not of Noah, but the sin of Ham in not stopping that event, whatever it really was, right? So the incident here is that Noah is drunk and is laying kind of openly naked in his own tent, and Ham sees that, and I don't precisely know exactly what this is, but the sin appears to be that he doesn't stop that in some way, that he goes and tells his brothers about it rather than stopping that. And the right action of his brothers is to come in, avert their faces, avert their eyes, and cover that up and stop it. And you'll notice that what you have in the aftermath of that is a curse upon Noah's middle son, Ham, and really his descendants. And so in verse 25, you finally have Noah speaking, right? The first words that Noah says in all of the Bible, "Cursed be Canaan. Lowest of slaves shall he be to his brothers." And so there's this curse upon Canaan, the descendants of Ham, and then you have the blessing upon the descendants of Shem and Japheth. And that really takes us into then this story about the dispersion of the nations in chapters 10 and the story of the Tower of Babel in chapter 11. So in many ways, this story in verse 18 sets that story up very well. I'll leave it to Sam to take anything else out of this that he wants to when he discusses that on Sunday. Again, read through chapter 11 for Sunday, and thanks for your attention and participation.